Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. This week, there were two hearings on Capitol Hill, one focusing on the IRS scandal over the targeting of conservative groups, and the other on how and why Apple Computer managed to avoid paying taxes on $44 billion in income over the last 4 years. That amounts to $17 million in taxes every day. Both of these hearings received widespread media coverage. The IRS scandal got the most coverage. On Wednesday, at the third hearing, IRS officials declined to cooperate with investigations to find out who authorized special scrutiny of 75 conservative groups that applied for tax-exempt status. Most officials simply said, "I don't know." Lois Lerner, director of exempt organizations at the IRS, said, quote, "I have not done anything wrong. I have not broken any laws." And then she refused to answer questions altogether. The DOJ is starting a criminal investigation, and the IRS is launching a 30-day inquiry. So why is this receiving so much media attention? Do you think it's warranted? Who's giving you the context you need about how the IRS operates? And with so much coverage, did you learn anything about social welfare tax exemption status, especially in light of all of the organizations that have come to play through the Citizens United decision 4 years ago? Joining us to talk about media coverage is Kevin Hall, chief economics correspondent with McClatchy's D.C. Bureau. In 2010, Kevin was a Pulitzer Prize finalist for national reporting for detailing in 2009 how Wall Street sold out investors and caused the nation's deep financial crisis. Hi, Kevin. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
Nice to have you. And on Tuesday, Apple CEO Tim Cook answered senators' questions about how Apple managed to avoid paying taxes on $44 billion in income over the last 4 years. This amounts to $17 million a day. The company stashed $100 billion in offshore subsidiaries. According to a U.S. Senate subcommittee, in addition to using loopholes to avoid paying taxes, the company has three Irish subsidiaries that claim to have no residence anywhere for tax purposes. Because of corporate tax loopholes, companies are legally avoiding paying taxes on an estimated $1.9 trillion. Joining us to discuss coverage of tax havens and tax dodgers is Michael Hudson. Michael covers business and finance for the Center for Public Integrity. Michael is one of 86 journalists from 46 countries who've produced the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists' investigation into offshore secrecy. Journalists looked at millions of files representing the largest stockpile of inside information about the offshore system ever obtained by a media organization. The total size of the files, measured in gigabytes, is more than 160 times larger than the leak of the U.S. State Department documents by WikiLeaks. And one of their main articles, Secrecy for Sale, is what it's called, the entire package. But inside the global offshore money maze says a cache of 2.5 million files has cracked open the secrets of more than 120,000 offshore companies and trusts, exposing hidden dealings of politicians, con men, and the mega rich the world over. Michael is author of The Monster, How a Gang of Predatory Lenders and Wall Street Bankers Fleeced America and Spawned a Global Crisis. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Rose. It's great to catch up again.
Yeah, it's great to have you again. And wow, your report is just massive. And there's been such a widespread response overseas. So we look forward to talking about that. But before we jump in, let's give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. We always like to start off on a positive note. So, Kevin, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
You know, mine isn't so much an important topic. It's in today's Wall Street Journal, kind of buried inside, about the person being floated to head the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. And most Americans don't know or care about the CFTC, but it is the agency that's in charge of those very complex derivatives that nearly blew up the world financial order. And she's the woman who's being considered to head this agency is a hardliner. Those who want looser rules won out on the implementing language recently, and so she's being considered as a way to kind of fight this fight again. I think it's technical issue, but one that's very important to all of us.
And when you say she's a hardliner, what do you mean exactly?
A hardliner in that she wants more regulation of derivatives and more more transparency, more oversight of this part of the financial world. And in that sense, she may face a lot of criticism up on the Hill by the Republicans and some Democrats. And it was a Democrat on the CFTC who had been considered the next chairman, the front runner for next chairman, but he sided with industry, and now he's out of the running.
And so if she gets this post, or is she already in, or does she have to get the post still?
No, she'd have to be nominated.
She has to be nominated. Okay. So at that point, if she does get it, how much power would she actually have?
Well, it's an interesting question, because it's the question that's before this whole Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, too. She would be one of several commissioners, one vote, one among many. And this has been the structure that's managed to gum everything up at the SEC, at the CFTC, and all these other agencies, where under the guise of bipartisanship, they can never get anything done. And in fact, the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, which Mr. Cordray was appointed as a recess appointment, and now that's been called into question, actually has a one person. It doesn't have to go through this complicated board process where everything gets watered down and nothing gets done.
So we should really keep track of this, because this is an important position. Even though a lot of people don't follow it, it does affect people's lives directly.
Yeah, and it's at the heart of what went wrong.
Okay, well, thank you for that. And also, on kind of a related note, the billionaire backer of President Obama, Penny Pritzker, is set to become Commerce Secretary. She's a net worth of over $1.5 billion and would become one of the wealthiest cabinet secretaries in U.S. history. So we've got to do a show on these appointments.
Yes.
So thank you, Kevin. And Michael, what about you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
You know what? I'm actually going to go back another week or so, because I think one of the most important sort of stories that's come out lately is just about the recovery of Fannie Mae. Earlier this month, the Los Angeles Times reported that Fannie Mae was going to pay a $59 billion dividend to the United States government. So, you know, there's plenty to criticize Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac for their activities leading up to the mortgage crisis and afterwards, too. But what's clear is that the U.S. taxpayers are not going to be on the hook, as we thought, for hundreds of billions of dollars in bailouts for Fannie and Freddie.
And how did that happen?
Just, you know, I think it, you know, the, you know, the talking point among a lot of folks was that, you know, Fannie and Freddie caused this. And, of course, reporting by Kevin and by other folks and myself has shown that really this was a private sector issue. And the reason that Fannie and Freddie were in such trouble, yes, they made some risky loans, but at a much lower rate than Wall Street backed lenders. But the reason that they were in such trouble is their entire business focus went under. The mortgage market tanked, and so they were in big trouble. But the mortgage market, the housing market, has started to slowly recover, and there are a lot of people still suffering, but things are looking better. Housing prices are going up, housing sales are going up. I'm surprised at how well the housing market has done.
When you look at what's happening in the Bay Area, it's rent is skyrocketing, but also the sales of homes are skyrocketing. In some cases, it's breaking records here in the Bay Area.
So there is, there obviously is danger that this could be a bubble and we could have another crash. But for now, you know, Fannie and Freddie seem to have recovered, or at least gotten their legs back.
Mm. And a lot of people are having a hard time finding housing because it's so expensive. I wanted to ask you both just quickly about a front page story on today's New York Times called Banks Lobbyists Help in Drafting Bills on Finance. The lead says bank lobbyists are not leaving it to lawmakers to draft legislation that softens financial regulations. Instead, the lobbyists are helping to write it themselves. You know, no huge surprise there, but one bill that sailed through the House Financial Services Committee this month over the objection of the Treasury Department was essentially Citigroup's, according to emails reviewed by the New York Times. The bill would exempt broad swaths of trades from new regulation. Kevin, have you been following this?
Not terribly closely, but it goes to the heart of that earlier mentioned story. There's this move to kind of undo the rules that were designed to constrict this sort of activity, this activity that doesn't really contribute. When you think of what markets originally, the origin of markets was to create, you know, capital formation. You sweat equity, you build a company, you take it private, take it public, etc. Everything's turned on its head right now, and these derivatives are just really, you know, it's a casino, basically. There's no other way to describe it.
The report goes on to say, and again, this is the New York Times front page, in a sign of Wall Street's resurgent influence in Washington, Citigroup's recommendations were reflected in more than 70 lines of the House Committee's 85-line bill, two crucial paragraphs prepared by Citigroup in conjunction with other Wall Street banks were copied nearly word for word. Lawmakers changed two words to make them plural. Michael, what are your thoughts on this?
I don't know. I guess, you know, Citibank is streamlining legislative process and cutting out the middleman. This is not new. That, you know, lobbyists have been, especially financial lobbyists, have been writing the laws, whether it was laws on mortgages, on subprime lending, for decades now. And there doesn't seem to be any real change.
They're also
backtracking.
They're also hiring, it's the senator's exit. They just hired, why am I drawing blanks on his name, who had been offered the post in Obama's administration at Commerce, the New Hampshire senator, who's now gone to work for them, as Tim Pawlenty has, the governor of Minnesota, Judd Gregg, or not Judd Gregg, right. But all these guys are now going to work for SIFMA and all the financial industry around the Hill, so it's just a revolving door.
Well, and speaking of the revolving door, I just have to bring this up quickly because it really didn't get much attention. A number of housing rights groups and Occupy groups were protesting in front of the DOJ to make a point about the fact that no bankers have been held responsible for the financial crisis. And a number of people got arrested. In fact, one video showed a young woman being violently arrested. She was tased for basically sitting down near a tent. And then a number of protesters were also in front of Attorney General Eric Holder's private law firm on Wall Street. They wanted to make a point by blocking the revolving doors so they couldn't move. And, you know, Kevin, I always, you know, watch these protests that don't get much coverage. And I wonder, you know, the big ones in D.C., why is it that Washington reporters just don't walk out of the office to go ask these people why they're doing this? I mean, a lot of these people have lost their homes.
Yeah. Well, I think part of it is simply there's, in a bureau like ours, we leave something, a story like that, we leave to the wires, and the wires do cover it because you're usually doing kind of the bigger enterprise focus piece. So I think that's the easy answer to that, but in terms of keeping the heat on, I think these groups are absolutely right. And, you know, we've written that story, you know, at least twice a year for the last 5 years, and it never seems to go up to the top. They end up always going after mid-level guys who really didn't have anything to do with it, or state-level guys, but never, you know, the people at the top who exited with, you know, huge paychecks.
And Michael, I mean, the other angle I think is important is the administration says, push us, push us. And when the people push them, they either get arrested or, in this case, they got tased.
Right. It's all about what you define as a crime. And white-collar financial fraud often is not defined as a crime, at most often defined as a civil wrong. And, you know, this kind of goes back to, you know, the FBI has bragged about, you know, we've done all these investigations of mortgage fraud, but then when you pull back the curtain and look at what they did, that, you know, they were going after low-level employees, literally loan officers and branch managers and street-level fraudsters. They don't define, you know, basically the FBI defined mortgage fraud as fraud against lenders, people who are lying to lenders to get loans. They don't define it as lenders committing fraud in a systematic way, and that's why we haven't had, and it's certainly in the mortgage space, which you know, of course, sparked the financial crisis, we haven't had those prosecutions of high-level people, and there hasn't been a lot of tough action against major banks and major lenders from the federal government.
And at this action, almost 18 people were arrested. The young woman that was arrested was 21-year-old Carmen Pittman, whose grandmother died shortly before J.P. Morgan Chase was preparing to foreclose on their home. So that action didn't get much attention. But Kevin, the Tea Partiers who were in D.C. sure got a lot of attention for protesting the IRS going after conservative groups.
Yeah. It's portrayed as a Tea Party event, and it really has. You know, they got the brunt of the focus, but I think, you know, realistically, there were groups of all sorts that were subject to it. And in my own mind, in my own reporting, I think the more egregious abuses were the Right to Life groups. You know, whether you like them or not, they have the right as citizens to form these sorts of organizations. They didn't seem any way connected to the political process in a way like a Tea Party or a progressive group, you know, that had progressive in its title. I think at the heart of this so-called scandal is this question of social welfare groups. How do you define them, and what do they do? We've gravitated over time to make that mean almost anybody who has an opinion on anything, and that was not the original intent of the IRS tax code.
So can you elaborate on this a bit? Because the reporting that I heard this week, and it got so much reporting, is that these were majority Tea Party groups.
Well, they were. They were probably on probably about a 60-40 basis. They were Tea Party groups, and if you add other conservative organizations, you probably get it up to about 70-30 in terms of the long list of people who were subject to this specialized screening. The screening itself was not necessarily something that was wrong. In fact, it was parts of, when I've looked at the actual questionnaires, some of them are dead on in asking what they should be asking, and then others were pretty far out of line. But I think, you know, they did disproportionately target these groups, and I think the reason why is probably pretty simple, that these are groups that were new actors in the political sphere and very much more present. And because of that, they warranted a closer look to make sure they weren't crossing that gray line. The problem is, if you're looking at these groups, why aren't you looking at Crossroads GPS and the Koch Industries or Organizing for America or any, you know, these big, you know, huge organizations that were clearly funnels for campaign money.
Right.
Nothing else.
Well, so were these 75 groups that the IRS targeted fairly small? How much money are we talking about?
Oh, we're talking about very small groups. Yeah. Like this woman in Iowa who I had interviewed who ran a Right to Life group, they had a budget of maybe $500,000 in donations.
Wow.
It was all citizen people. It wasn't... and they've been doing what they've done for a long time, but it is very against our grain when an IRS agent can ask, you know, basically said, here, sign, we'll give you your status, but you have to sign a letter saying you're not going to protest in front of Planned Parenthood. You know, the fact is, they have the right to protest in front of Planned Parenthood, and that's a linkage that never should be there, regardless of whether the left or the right.
That is Kevin Hall. He's chief economics correspondent for McClatchy's D.C. Bureau. We're talking about coverage of the IRS going after 75 conservative applicants, reviewing the tax-exempt status. I should be more specific about that. So this got wall-to-wall coverage. What are your thoughts? Do you think it was warranted? Kevin brings up, and a lot of reporters, people at Columbia Journalism Review, for example, say, well, what about these large groups like Karl Rove's group or GPS or the Koch brothers and all of the groups that are involved with that? What are your thoughts on that, and what did you learn about how the IRS looks at the various organizations that have popped up since the Citizens United decision in 2010? And then we're also going to talk about media coverage of Apple CEO Tim Cook being questioned on Capitol Hill about why the company did not pay taxes on $44 billion in income over the last 4 years. That's $17 million a day. There's a larger question here, though, obviously, when it comes to tax dodgers and corporate tax loopholes. And we'll talk about that later in the show. So if anything struck you about this coverage, where did you see good coverage, bad coverage? And then if there was a story you saw that you'd like to talk about, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. And be sure to check our website for Michael Hudson's very in-depth, exhaustive report on offshore secrecy. 86 journalists from 46 countries worked on this investigation. And Michael, what are your thoughts on all the attention this IRS, I don't know, do you call it a scandal? Is that the right word? That's the word I heard all week.
You know, I'm not sure because I don't know if enough facts, this seems to be an ideological argument rather than a fact-based inquiry. So I don't know. to tell whether it's a scandal, you really need to know the details, and I don't think those have been scrutinized enough.
Kevin, what do you think? Is it good to call it? Is it right to call it a scandal?
I think it is. When you target somebody because of their political name, I mean, I think that does go against the fabric of our political system and our rights. That said, you know, we don't have all the facts, and I find it very interesting that, you know, more than 2 weeks into this mess, nobody can give a name of the person who actually came up with the criteria. For, you know, if you look at the actual documents that are written from IRS employees to these groups, several of these groups, it's barely written in English. So it's written by someone who's almost functionally illiterate in terms of the use of the English language. They didn't come up with these ideas and these criteria, clearly, if they can't write a simple sentence in English. So clearly this was designed by someone, and no one, after 2.5 weeks, is saying how this came about.
John Stewart actually had a great piece on both of these hearings, the IRS hearing and then Apple CEO Tim Cook being questioned. And with the IRS, he just played these officials over and over saying, I don't know, I don't know.
Uh-huh.
And so where does this go from here?
Well, I think at some point we will know, and I don't know if it's the Justice Department that dislodges that information. You know, the Inspector General in his testimony suggested that because he couldn't compel people under oath to talk, he was not getting a lot of cooperation. And then you see the political circus that's become, that certainly would make one hesitant to be terribly cooperative, too. But I suspect there's more there, because usually by now somebody's thrown under the bus and trying to move to the next, in this town, the next scandal or whatever. But the fact that nobody's been able to cough up names of the people who came up with this idea and how it came about suggests that there is some protection going on of somebody for some reason. So I think this story still has a good ways to go.
And Kevin, we took a look at your reporting. You've done a lot of reporting on this over the last 2 weeks. What have you learned in your reporting that you're seeing missing from just, you know, the headlines we get on the radio, for example?
Well, I mean, I guess so much of the reporting is focused on the politics of it and the grandstanding. And I think, you know, if you dig down lower than that and look what, you know, the issues that are actually at stand, I think the bigger issue is, why do we have this subsidy to begin with? Mm-hmm. In a time when we're so tight financially, or supposed to be so tight fiscally and in need of money, why are we giving all these different groups tax-exempt status? It's a subsidy. You know, and there's a certain irony that groups who are against the government are asking for government subsidies so they can protest the government. That in itself, but I think the thing that it highlights is the need to really take a hard look at why these, you know, how this law has evolved, or the status has evolved, and is it really serving the purpose? I mean, Citizens United, the court ruling that ruled that corporations are people, changes everything, because nonprofit corporations are corporations. So some smart lawyer thought, well, if nonprofits are also corporations, then we don't have to declare. You know, if I give money to a PAC, I have to give my name. If I give money to a nonprofit, I don't. You know, so these immediately became instruments and were huge. ProPublica had some numbers that last August, you know, months before the election, spending on TV ads by these groups had eclipsed spending by PACs, super PACs.
Wow. Well, so we're going to take a quick break, and I'd love to ask you after the break, how much money are we talking about when these groups are being subsidized? How much is this? Kevin Hall is chief economics correspondent for McClatchy's D.C. Bureau. We're also joined by Michael Hudson. He covers business and finance for the Center for Public Integrity. And we'll also, after the break, talk about Apple and tax dodgers. It's your call, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on Local Public Radio. All of the stories you hear recommended on the Friday Media Roundtable are posted at yourcallradio.org, and they're also included in Your Call's weekly email newsletter. It's free and easy to sign up for. Just click the email newsletter link at yourcallradio.org. And you can highlight the reporting you thought was valuable this week by calling 866-798-8255 or sending an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
We'll be right back.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll rebroadcast a conversation we recently had about efforts to restore the honeybee population. Honeybees have been mysteriously disappearing across the planet. The EU recently announced plans to ban 3 bee killer pesticides. They're still legal in the U.S. So why is this happening? And how do bees affect our food and ecosystems? We're also putting shows together next week about public banking. And Thursday, we will feature a new documentary about incredible environmentalists in Northern California that have successfully fought for free space. What can we learn from them? Today, it is our media roundtable. And we're joined by Kevin Hall, chief economics correspondent with McClatchy's D.C. Bureau, talking about media coverage of, I should say, wall-to-wall media coverage of IRS officials going after tax-exempt status of 75 conservative applicants. And we are talking with Michael Hudson. He covers business and finance for the Center for Public Integrity. He's one of 86 journalists from 46 countries who've produced international consortium of investigative journalists investigation into offshore secrecy. And we'd love to hear from you if you've got comments on these two issues. What did you see that was done well in the media? What wasn't? And if there is a story you saw that deserves more attention, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. And Kevin, before we get to calls, when you're talking about these groups that are subsidized, how much money is this?
Well, that's a hard one to figure out because it's money that they don't, because absent the subsidy, it doesn't mean they would necessarily pay taxes because they would find other ways to put that money into campaigns or in other places. So we looked into that. We couldn't come up with anything remotely useful because it there's no way to know what they would do in the absence of this.
All right. Well, let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Chris in Oakland. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Great topic, and I love your show.
Thank you.
I'm going to join the John Stewart Appreciation Society as well. I just watched last night a segment from this week where he showed Peggy Noonan's performance on Meet the Press last weekend, where she not only gave a scathing criticism of the Obama administration's so-called scandals, but she kept making this weird face, like a very crinkled nose face, like she couldn't stand to even talk about these things. And then Stewart went into the archives and found her giving both gushing praise and sort of absolving Ronald Reagan time after time in reference to the Iran-Contra affair. And I think, you know, we're inundated with so much commentary in the corporate media that we really need to see who these commentators are and what their standards are and how consistent they are or aren't. And I thought that was just brilliant.
Yeah, well, yeah, and that's what The Daily Show does so well. Going into the conversation about Apple, Michael, what I thought John Stewart did so well is, you know, before in the lead up to the hearing in which CEO Tim Cook answered questions about how Apple managed to avoid paying taxes on $44 billion in income over the last 4 years, so many outlets said he's going to get grilled. And in fact, the day after, a lot of outlets said he got grilled. Well, I didn't watch the testimony, but then when I saw Stewart, I mean, he showed these senators gushing over Apple. I love iPods. My daughter uses one. I want an iPad. You're so innovative. I mean, it was really interesting to watch. What are your thoughts overall on how this specific hearing was covered? Michael?
Yeah, you know, I think it was covered pretty well. I mean, if you read the Washington Post coverage, say, from Cecilia Kang, and other folks, unfortunately, I think a lot of the TV news, because it's you know, so focused on the sort of quick sound bite, you're just not going to get what really happened. But a lot of what I've read made it clear that the senators were gushing, and that they were sort of treating the CEO like a celebrity, like a movie star, And, you know, of course, that's not unusual when CEOs come to Congress. And it's also not unusual for just our general media culture to treat CEOs, until their company crashes and burns, but treat CEOs as celebrities, as, you know, give them the star treatment.
The New York Times' Nelson Schwartz and Brian Chen wrote, Timothy Cook came to the lion's den on Capitol Hill on Tuesday, prepared to face down lawmakers furious over evidence that Apple, the famous company he runs, has avoided paying billions in taxes. By the time Mr. Cook walked out, the big cats on a Senate committee were practically eating out of his hand. That is the lead in the New York Times piece.
And this is important because, you know, the news media, for all its reputation for being a watchdog of government, often, you know, looks to public officials to set the agenda. And on the tax issue in Europe, you've got people like David Cameron talking about the scourge of tax evasion. You've got the president of France talking about how we need to eradicate tax havens. In the U.S., you don't see that sort of level of concern from public officials. And I think that's reflected in the U.S. media coverage. There has been definitely some coverage of this issue, but it hasn't been in the same volume or with the same intensity as we're seeing now in Europe.
Yeah, although, interestingly enough, there's been a lot of moves on individuals and offshore accounts. The IRS has gone out, you know, pretty much closed down UBS and Wegelin and a bunch of the big Swiss banks. But that involves individuals not declaring their taxes, where we don't seem to care at all about corporations and how much they do or don't pay.
Yeah, and why do you think this is, Kevin? Because, you know, Michael's massive, massive piece that he took part in, I mean, they've got a piece called Global Leaders Respond to Release of Offshore Records. And, I mean, you've got finance ministries and EU councils and prime ministers, heads of state, I mean, taking massive action because of what has been exposed. In the U.S., you don't have that.
Yeah, and instead in the U.S. we have a debate over, you know, is our corporate rate too high, when, in fact, nobody pays the corporate rate. They pay the effective rate, which is always much lower. Apple complained, and maybe Michael knows, Apple's saying that they have a 30% effective rate. I find that really hard to believe. I don't know if that was that credible.
I'm not sure if that that is credible. It's, you know, lies, damn lies, and statistics.
Yeah, because most corporations are in the 25 to 28 range, which is exactly what they're talking about if they do this simplification and lower the corporate tax rates, but do away with all the knockoffs. But, you know, John Stewart joining the John Stewart fan club was dead on when he said, you know, how did this get so complex? Corporations made it this way.
Right. And you just said the magic word there, Kevin, simple. Apple CEO Tim Cook repeated that word over and over again. Simple. We need a simple tax code. And some of the senators actually asked him, well, how should we change it? Michael, what are your thoughts on that? The senators actually asking a CEO how the tax code should be changed.
Well, I think it's fine to ask the CEO that, but it's also probably good to be asking other people too, like academic economists, union officials, just, you know, a broad swathe of people, and not, you know, but often we seem to turn to CEOs as kind of the superstars, the gurus who can tell us what's happening in the economy, and as we saw with the financial crisis, you know, you could go through with hundreds of different statements, you know, all is well, you know, the market is, you know, the market's hit the bottom, it's going back up now, and so on. You see that, you know, CEOs are, you know, there are a lot of smart ones, but there are a lot of not so smart ones, and they can't see around corners.
Yeah. Warren Buffett hit the nail on the head when he said CEOs could live with a 35% or a 30% rate or whatever the rate is, as long as it's consistent. What they can't live with is the bouncing around, because they can't make, you know, long-term plans. But this idea that they can't live with, you know, a 30% or a 35% rate is just false. You know, the people do it all over the place. It's the moving target that makes it tough.
And a Business Insider headline was, Apple avoids paying $17 million in taxes every day through a ballsy but genius tax avoidance scheme. And they write, Apple uses a variety of offshore structures and arrangements to shift billions from the U.S. to Ireland. So, Michael, everything they're doing is legal. Is that right?
Well, the It seems to be, but, you know, that's open for question, open for investigation. You know, what offshore is about is about shadows and apparitions. It's about creating the appearance of things that aren't really so. So, for instance, you know, this Apple Operations International, this Irish holding company through which Apple channeled, you know, much of its profits around the world, you know, was supposedly based in Ireland. It had no offices there. It had no employees there. 32 of its last 33 board meetings were in California. And here's the key thing. The money really wasn't in Ireland. It was actually managed by another Apple company in Nevada, and it was kept in New York banks.
Wow.
So a lot of this is sort of a, you know, and I think with Google, you know, some British lawmakers have accused Google of using smoke and mirrors. So a lot of this is, and you know, if you look at it not from an ethical or legal perspective, but just on style points, you know, if you're like a drama critic, it's quite impressive. You know, a company that can shift billions of dollars and have no employees. You have shell companies with these faux directors. They're called nominee directors. So you have companies, and the nominee director's job is to essentially lend their name to a company as director and then know absolutely nothing about this company, sort of the Sergeant Schultz, I know nothing. And so as part of our investigation, we found nominee directors who were directors of hundreds and sometimes thousands of companies around the world. So when there was a problem, when tax authorities or police came to them to do an investigation and said, what can you tell us about what's going on with this particular company, they could very accurately and honestly say, I don't know, because that's how the system is set up.
That is Michael Hudson. He covers business and finance for the Center for Public Integrity, worked on this massive investigation into offshore secrecy with 85 other journalists from 46 countries. We're also joined by Kevin Hall, Chief Economics Correspondent with McClatchy's D.C. Bureau. And you can join us at 866-798-8255 if you'd like to talk about media coverage of tax issues. This is so incredibly important, especially as we're facing massive budget cuts. I mean, when you look at, for example, the school lunch program, 200,000 students might lose school lunches, and this stuff is all connected. So what are your thoughts on how this gets covered? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's go to Charles in San Francisco. Hi, Charles. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Rose, and your panelists. Great show. I just want to point out a couple things real briefly. One person who's done awesome coverage on this IRS issue is Lawrence O'Donnell of MSNBC, who points out a couple things. Number one, to be a 504, you don't actually even have to apply to the IRS, interestingly enough. You can simply declare yourself as a 504 when filing. Number two, nobody was denied a 504 applicant status when they after they did apply to the IRS, so no one was really harmed other than having to answer some questions. And number three, part of this issue comes down to an ambiguity that kind of came from the 50s in terms of the law says that in order to be a 504, you have to exclusively be a social welfare organization, but for some reason in the 50s, the IRS reinterpreted that to being primarily a social welfare, and nobody has, and so these questions were to determine what the level of social welfare activity was of these organizations, if you understand what I'm saying.
Right. Well, Kevin, go ahead.
Yeah, this was touched on in the hearings, in the last two hearings, and 1959 was the year that it kind of morphed from exclusive to primary, and from there it kind of became by rule rather than law, rather than statute, it became a situation where at least 51% of your activity had to be social welfare, the other 49 could be somehow related to campaigns, but all that evolution was really more recent than it was dating back to 59. The caller is correct in that you don't have to actually wait for approval. You declare yourself one, and then the IRS later determines whether or not you actually are. But that's one of the reasons the numbers are kind of funny on it, too, because that was actually a rule change fairly recently. Originally, you had to apply, get approval, and then you had to be reapproved in 5 years. So there's been a little bit of a, you know, to streamline the process, they let you do that up front. As for anybody being harmed, the caller is correct that nobody has been denied. There have been denials. They have been sent back for changes, but they have, I would argue that if you've had to wait 2 or 3 years for your status, then you probably have been harmed.
Well, thank you for calling. We also have an email from Leslie who wants to give kudos to MSNBC's Lawrence O'Donnell. She says that most of the other media, including other MSNBC, quote, liberals, latched on to the IRS scandal that she says simply doesn't exist. The real scandal is that in the end, these entirely political groups receive tax exemptions. Thank you for that email, Leslie. And let's go next to Bob in Richmond. Hi, Bob. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rose. And to ask, and I can take it off the air, but in the last presidential debate, and even in the recent debates over restructuring the national finances, you know, nobody pursues the issue of lobby connections to the tax credits. And I can't help but think that obviously Apple and a number of others have the simple non-rocket science perception, which is that they have Congress people in their pockets. And I don't know about the nonprofit types, but can you say anything about that? I mean, it seems like this is sort of the elephant in the room, and can anything be done about that?
Well, thank you so much. I just searched for this. Apple Insider is reporting that Apple is on pace to double lobbying spending on taxes and other issues. Apple could spend $4 million lobbying politicians on the Hill, twice what the company spent last year, and more than 20 times the $180,000 it spent in 1999. It's funny, Kevin, it's not funny, but it's odd. Whenever we talk about lobbying, I mean, $4 million for these companies is not much, and look what they get in return.
Yeah, for sure, and I think some of this lobbying is in on behalf of this broader question of, are we going to have comprehensive tax reform, or are we going to have, some have suggested we can have corporate tax reform without broader reform, but then you get this whole question of what about companies that don't file as a corporation but as a pass through, so it gets a little more complex. But I suspect that's why they're spending the money the way they are. But the other issue in this, there are real issues, which is traditionally you've got this idea, this problem of, if a company's made its money overseas, should that money, for instance, your operations in China, should you have to pay taxes in the U.S. if you pay taxes in China? And that's part of the whole, this question of a territorial tax system is a legitimate debate, and I think it's one that needs to be done, because we've had this evolution of kind of globalization, so a company doesn't make all its money here. But that's also a fig leaf for a company to do what Apple did, which is to create all this complex scheme of things where you can shift funds around and you never incur costs and profits anywhere. You incur costs everywhere, but you never seem to incur profits anywhere, which is the way they game the system. Can I jump back to one from your previous, from your the email that just came in?
Please.
There is more to the story than just, you know, the 24-hour coverage about who spied on whom. The fact, the way they publicize this, the way they apologize for this, is really what is the bigger issue, because the IRS tried to front-run the results of a critical report from the Inspector General. That's, Inspector Generals are supposed to be the public's watchdog, so they were trying to cut off the Inspector General at the pass, soften what he found, and to me that's as much a damning part of this story as anything else, and why Lois Lerner's head finally came yesterday, because the fact that they planted a story, they had someone, a tax lawyer on their advisory panel, plant the question for them and ask them this question so they could try to neutralize the effects. And all of that, I think, contributes. It's not just the Tea Party.
That is Kevin Hall, Chief Economics Correspondent from McClatchy's D.C. Bureau. We're also joined by Michael Hudson. He covers business and finance for the Center for Public Integrity. He's one of 86 journalists from 46 countries who've produced this investigation into offshore secrecy. And Michael, how did this massive package of stories come about? What sparked this in the first place?
Our executive director at the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, Gerald Ryle, was working as a journalist in Australia doing an investigation of a massive fraud there. And as part of that investigation, he made some contacts and eventually led to him getting a computer hard drive in the mail with essentially 2.5 million records about offshore companies and trust, about 120,000 companies and limited liability companies and family trust, and about 10 different tax havens around the world, with a big focus on the British Virgin Islands and Singapore and the Cook Islands and the South Pacific. And so, you know, this is such a massive trove of information that we knew that the only way to do this story was to staff up and get people around the world to work with us, and especially, you know, we don't know who the key players are, who the politicians are, say in Thailand or the Philippines. So we had people on the ground who had the experience, had the knowledge, look through data pertaining to their country.
And I mean, it's a huge question. What did you learn? We'll have to do an entire show on this.
Right.
But what really, based on the investigations you've done, what really strikes you about the data you uncovered?
Well, I think how complex the system is, the links to which individuals and companies go to get secrecy, to get legal insulation, to prevent themselves. Essentially, what happens when you set up a trust in the Cook Islands, somebody sues you in America, you lose a judgment, and you say, well, okay, I've lost a ruling in court, but you know what? If you want the money, you got to come to the Cook Islands and start over again. Thousands of miles from the U.S. mainland, where you have to retry the case again under a heightened burden of proof. And in most cases, the plaintiffs will just settle. So in some ways, what has happened is in those cases, the Cook Islands have substituted their legal system for the American legal system. And it allows wealthy people to shop for jurisdiction where they're going to fight those kind of battles.
And what sort of media coverage have you received on this package here in the United States?
We've gotten a lot of coverage in the United States, but I would say that it's much less coverage and less intensity than in Europe. We kept track the first month, the number of media mentions and pickups of our stories, and it was more than 5,000 in Europe. It was about 1,000 in the United States. In the United States, it was more of a sort of a one-day or two-day or three-day story. Got a lot of attention. We had a front-page story in the Washington Post that we collaborated on. But in Europe, it was a front-page story for days on end. There was, one paper in Spain that wasn't even part of our team that did a five-page special section all about the investigation. And it's just, we've gotten so many calls and so much attention.
I mean, that's incredible. 5,000 articles in Europe and only 1,000 in the U.S.
Right.
What about response? I'm holding this article, Release of Offshore Records Draws Worldwide Response. This is about 7.5 pages of how governments around the world are responding to this investigation. A France minister, central bankers at the G20 said that automatic exchange of tax relevant bank information should be adopted as the global standard. I mean, the UK, the EU, the Swiss, Germany, Russia, you name it. But how has the US government responded at all?
Not really. Most of the response has been from overseas, and some of it has been, Europe's five biggest economic powers, Britain, France, Germany, Italy, and Spain, announced that they would begin regularly exchanging banking and tax information as a way of identifying tax dodgers. In the Philippines, the authorities are now investigating the eldest daughter of Ferdinand Marcos, who's now a provincial governor. We uncovered that she had offshore holdings, and Philippine authorities are trying to find out if those offshore holdings contain any money that her father looted while he was in power. So, and there have been official investigations in India, in Greece. The deputy speaker of the House in Mongolia resigned his position as a result of our reporting. Just today, the one of Europe's most famed bankers, the chief executive of Raiffeisen Bank in Vienna has resigned his position because of reporting by our media partners in Germany and Austria about his offshore holdings.
And that bank...
We knew we would get reaction, but we've been sort of shocked at how much reaction. And part of it is, it's not just... it's a circular process. When there's public reaction, when there's government reaction, when governments and leaders react, then the media, continue to cover the issue. That, of course, encourages public officials to continue to address the issue, and so on. And so, it keeps going. And in the U.S., you just haven't had that, partly because U.S. officials have not really responded to our investigation, or in general, to a lot of the concerns about tax evasion. It may be that they want to do things more quietly. They're in negotiations with people like Luxembourg and other countries about sharing information, and they've had some successes about getting information.
But, well, and now you have a Penny Pritzberg who might be heading the U.S. Commerce Department, whose family has direct connections to tax avoidance. And Kevin, we've got about 30 seconds left. You wanted to jump in?
Yeah, on Pritzker, look for the Bloomberg. Your readers can look for your listeners can listen to look for the Bloomberg articles on Pritzker. They've done tremendous work and shown she's got like 141 different offshore trusts, and she's got to step down from 21 boards. And
wow.
All kinds. It's fascinating. But I think the U.S., the interesting response, and Michael, correct me if I'm wrong, the FATCA, F-A-T-C-A, these are the tax sharing agreements that the U.S. is starting to enter into with other countries. Rand Paul has made this a personal crusade against this, saying it's against all our principles to have to share tax information with other countries.
Yeah, he also chastised senators for going after Apple CEO Tim Cook this week. But we've got to do a show on this. So thank you so much. Kevin Hall, chief economics correspondent for McClatchy's D.C. Bureau, and Michael Hudson. He covers business and finance for the Center for Public Integrity. Find their work at yourcallradio.org. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Kevin. Thanks, Rose.
Thanks.
Thank you. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Thanks for listening. Are honeybees disappearing? On the next Your Call, we'll rebroadcast a conversation we recently had about efforts to restore the honeybee population. Known as the colony collapse disorder, honeybees have been mysteriously disappearing across the planet. The European Union recently announced plans to ban 3 bee killer pesticides, but they're still legal in the U.S. So how are pesticides contributing to the decline? Why is this happening? And how do bees affect our food and ecosystems? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David LaTulip is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.